turn your head, but it won't go away. This heated struggle's brought a chill to me. One side says it's right, while the other's left to go down in the mine and dig their way out of debt.
That strike lasted almost a year, not a single mine worker crossed the picket line.
Wow.
Not one.
Wow.
Not one.
35 years ago this week, on April 5th, 1989, miners at Pittston Coal walked off the job. The strike by 1,700 miners from Virginia, Kentucky, and West Virginia lasted nearly 11 months. Much like last year's Hollywood strikes, the Pittston strike brought together the labor movement at a time when it was at a low ebb. It seems like everyone found their way to Camp Solidarity that year. I remember driving a truck full of food down from upstate New York and being welcomed like a long-lost brother from people who'd never laid eyes on me before. Back in 2019, labor historian Joe McCartan sat down with Richard Trumka to talk about that historic strike. Trumka had led the mine workers during the Pittston strike and then gone on to lead the AFL-CIO as president from 1995 until he died unexpectedly in August 2021. So this is a special opportunity to revisit Joe's interview. We're going to begin today's show by remembering another anniversary, that of the Upper Big Branch mine disaster.
The year was 2010. A massive explosion ripped through Massey Energy's mine in Raleigh County, West Virginia. The explosion killed 29 miners. It was the deadliest in decades.
I'm Chris Garlock, and this is Labor History Today.
The miner's life is hard enough without having to keep an eye on the greed from up above. Fat cats are creeping, trying to chip away the hard-earned road that generations have paved into the neighborhoods of finer homes that 50 years ago a miner couldn't own. Well, the UAW got swept under the rug. Before they let that happen here, they're gonna take it to the streets. 'Cause enough is enough is enough. Mr. Bush did no good.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. The year was 2010. A massive explosion ripped through Massey Energy's mine in Raleigh County, West Virginia. The explosion killed 29 miners. It was the deadliest in decades. The explosion at the Upper Big Branch mine revealed the ruthlessness of profit-driven mine executives. Raking in $104 million in profit the year before, they callously insisted the explosion had been an act of God. The explosion also exposed the immense pressure on federal and state regulators to look the other way or go easy on enforcement. And it demonstrated just how deep the ties go between industry, regulators, and those in seats of political power. The Upper Big Branch mine explosion served as a testament to the increasingly unsafe and non-union nature of the industry. 35 years ago, 95% of the state's mines were unionized. Walkouts over health and safety were common. Now, less than 25% are. And the workers risk their livelihoods if they dare to speak up about safety. Autopsies of those killed in the explosion revealed that over 70% of them were found to have had black lung disease, an entirely preventable disease with proper ventilation. Massey executives routinely violated safety rules as a cost of doing business. American University's detailed study of Massey's safety record for the years 2000 through 2010 concluded that no other U.S. coal company had a worse fatality record. A total of 54 workers, including those at the Upper Big Branch mine, had been killed during that time period. They also found that Massey had been cited for nearly 63,000 violations, including more than 25,000 considered significant and substantial. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Rick will be back later in the show with part two of our remembrance of the Upper Big Branch mine disaster. On April 5th, 1989, mine workers president Richard Trumka called a selective strike against Pittston Coal. The strike lasted nearly 11 months, and the key turning point came on September 17th of that year, when 98 United Mine Workers of America members and a minister occupied the Pittston Coal Company's Moss 3 preparation plant in Carbon, Virginia. The successful occupation and strike came at the end of a decade of brutal union busting that had begun with Ronald Reagan firing 11,000 striking air traffic controllers. Labor History Today's Joe McCartan sat down with Trumka, then president of the AFL-CIO, in September 2019, just before the 30th anniversary of the historic Pittston strike.
President Rich Trumka, welcome to Labor History Today.
Thanks for having me on.
It's wonderful to be with you, especially in this historic week. We're coming up on a week that marks a very important anniversary in your life and career. On September 17th, 1989, a bunch of members of your union sat in at Pittston Coal Company and started a historic struggle, one of the most important in recent labor history. And then, almost exactly to the day, 20 years later, you were elected as president of the AFL-CIO. So this is a big week of anniversaries for you. And so I think it's an appropriate time for us to sit down with you and talk a little bit of history, your own history, and also the history of the labor movement.
Great.
So I thought I'd start, Rich, by asking you a little bit about, you know, what you absorbed about history and the mine workers growing up in Nema Coal in Pennsylvania.
Well, it's everything I am and everything I was, probably. I learned around the kitchen table, mostly, because everybody in my family was a miner. I'm third generation. Mm-hmm. Both my grandfathers, my dad, both of his brothers, six of my uncles, and a number of my cousins were all miners. And so we talked about the struggles that miners had. I learned about honoring a picket line at before I went to school.
Wow.
And believed that they stood in solidarity with workers. That's the only way you made progress. And that's been the pole star of my life.
So you learned about the UMW from your dad and his relatives and stuff growing up?
And it was our life. I mean, the town that I was in, there was one thing you did. You were a miner, and you were either on the company side or the union side.
Right.
And so if you were on the union side, you learned about the union very, very quickly. Everything in the town, quite frankly, revolved around the union hall.
Because
the company owned everything in the town except two things.
Wow.
They didn't own the Catholic Church, and they didn't own the union hall. So every event, every birthday party, every dance on Friday night, every wedding, even voting took place in the union hall.
Wow. How old were you when you went into the mines?
18.
So right out of high school?
Right.
Yeah. What was it like to work in the mines in those days?
I still remember my first day in the mine. I went into the mine with my dad, and my dad was a machine operator.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd never seen him operate a machine, obviously. Mm-hmm. So I went underground, I see him the first day, and I was awed.
Wow.
By it. And I came out of the mine, and my mother said, "What was it like?" I said, "It was incredible. I enjoyed it a lot. I got to work with Dad." She goes, "What was it like watching him?" And I said, "It was like watching a ballerina dance."
Wow.
He was so graceful. I mean, there was no wasted movement with the machine. It was just like, it literally was like a ballerina dancing. And he tried to teach me to operate the same way, and I'm not sure I ever achieved the same level of proficiency that he had, but I tried real hard.
That's amazing. So you saw a side of him on that first day you had not been able to see, probably.
Well, and then my dad and I worked together for a number of years, so I knew him in ways that even his wife and my mother of 60-some years didn't know him.
Wow. And so you went into the mines, but you also got a degree from Penn State. How were you able to do it?
I first went in, and the union saw something in me, so the union decided to help me. And I would work a midnight shift in the mine, and then I would go to school in the daytime, travel and to one of the branch campuses of Penn State. And then I ran out all the courses there, I went on a 6 and 6 month program where I'd work in the mine 6 months and go to school 6 months. I graduated from Penn State, and the union then sent me to law school, and it was sort of the same thing. I worked in the mines and went to law school.
You didn't do a lot of sleeping in those days.
I still don't. It was good training.
Yeah, okay. And so you went to Villanova Law School.
I did.
And the union sent you.
Yep, they did.
Mm-hmm.
I was blessed that they sent me. I came out of law school, and the union hired me in the legal department here in the headquarters in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
My first assignment was negotiating the 1974 National Bituminous Coal Wage Agreement. I was on the negotiating team.
Wow. As a, what, 25-year-old or 24-year-old? Wow.
Yeah. And then I started doing cases. I tried a lot of cases, federal cases, trial level, and at the Court of Appeals, NLRB stuff. Tried cases around the country and did well. We missed a big part of it. The big part of it was that actually formulated where I am and my philosophy. I became a member of the Miners for Democracy,
right,
which was a group of miners that were tired of the autocratic rule that had been established by Tony Boyle and the lack of democracy.
Right.
The fact that we couldn't elect any of our representatives, we couldn't ratify a contract, then you couldn't even get a copy of the Constitution or the contract. They would tell you, we'll tell you when you have a grievance. And so I became a member of Miners for Democracy, and that had a big effect on
that. Was not long view after the Jock Yablonski killing, right?
No, I was in a mine actually before Jock got killed.
Wow.
And I was part of, I knew Jock.
You did?
I was supporter of Jock in the election. I was our first candidate.
Mm-hmm.
Jock got killed on New Year's Eve, 1969 into 70.
Mm-hmm.
He and his wife and his daughter Charlotte were murdered by a henchman that Tony Boyle had sent to kill them.
Right.
Because we had had an election that year in 69.
Mm-hmm.
It was a crooked election. I can give you a chapter and verse on that.
Yeah.
Because my law school thesis was on the effectiveness of the LMRDA in light of the 69 mine workers election.
Right.
So I did all the research on it. But it was a crooked election, and we were going to get a new election, and Tony ended up dispatching three people from Tennessee to kill them, and did.
Yeah.
And then we got a new candidate. We had a convention in Wheeling, West Virginia, a rank-and-file convention, and elected Arnold Miller to be the presidential candidate, Mike Trbovich to be the vice president, and Harry Patrick to be the secretary treasurer.
Mm-hmm. And so in this period, you moved from being a lawyer to getting involved more in union politics?
Well, I started off when I was at the mine. I got elected as chairman of the safety committee, and then I held different offices at the local union level. Then I went in the legal department with the mine workers. And Arnold and I had a, we had some philosophical disagreements. And so I told him that I would resign. I went up and drafted out a resignation, brought it down.
Mm-hmm.
Resigned, went back to the mine. Mm-hmm. That's when people truly thought I was crazy.
Yeah.
Going back into
people
the mine.
People usually don't go back in.
With a law degree. But, you know, it was some of the best times of my life, though.
Mm-hmm.
I practiced pro bono law.
Mm-hmm.
I never charged a miner for anything, not even court costs or filing fees. I ate it all. But I did black lung cases. I did the different type of cases that miners needed help on. And we even did a few of adoptions and things like that to help miners and stuff. And so it was a fun time, I mean, because I was working in a mine. I was a union officer.
Yeah.
And I was having fun practicing law, doing things that I love for people that I love.
And it wasn't very long thereafter you were elected president of the UMW.
Yeah, 82.
November. And the youngest president, I believe, at least since John Mitchell, right?
Correct. Right.
So how did it happen? That's quite a remarkable quick rise.
You know, I went to the executive board, and all I did was represent my district and try to stand up for workers. And not allow the institutional bias or spool of thing to try to tug me away from my love and belief in rank and file miners. Pretty quick, it seemed like people started coalescing around me. People that were on the board that were looking for a better way. And then Arnold got sick, and Sam Church took over. And Sam, back at that period of time, there were some people I would call them unsavory.
Yeah.
And they were involved, and I asked him not to let them get involved with us because we owned the National Bank of Washington at that time.
Right.
We had a large pension fund. And there were people that wanted to get their hooks into it.
Of course.
And he told me he knew what he was doing the first time. The second time I went back and I said, this is outside. It wasn't me making a big pitch in an executive council meeting. It was me talking to him privately, saying, you can't let this happen. He said, I know what I'm doing. The third time I got even more concerned. I came in and I said, I just want you to know. I want you to be the first one to hear this. I'm going to run against you because of what you're doing. I'm not going to let my union, the three generations that Trump has fought for and tried to build, get taken over by people that care only about raping and draining what people fought for. So I'm not going to do that.
What did he say?
He said, you don't have a chance.
Okay.
And I said, we'll see.
All right. So you're elected in 1982, and one thing we haven't mentioned about that time is it's the Reagan era. So you take over the mine workers after a period of turmoil in the union, as we've talked about, at a time when employers are trying to break the union, and at a time when a president is in the White House who probably does more damage to the labor movement than anybody since before Roosevelt. So what was it like to come into the leadership of a historic union in that moment?
You know, first we had a number of things that we had to do internally and externally. The union was hemorrhaging finances, and so we had to take that over, stop it from happening. It was being run sort of like a clubhouse, and so it was like try to bring back quality people to take care of it. When we started doing that, and then we started looking externally at what we had to do. We had a lot of resources at our hand. You had the money in the pension fund. You had the bank stuff and things of that sort. So we started figuring out ways to use them to the best advantage of the membership to get us strong again. We started preparing for what we knew was going to be a battle. And you remember during that period of time, everybody was making concessions, giving back stuff. And I ran on a platform of no backward steps. So I said, we're not going to take concessions. We're not going to go backwards. And everybody said, you're crazy. This industry's coming after you, and you're going to have to give concessions or you're going to have to fight. And I said, we're going to fight. So we began preparing our membership. And we actually did, two contracts, the first two contracts, without a strike, no backward step, and we made progress. We actually got raises, better benefits, and we were, no backward step was adhered to. And then we ran into a company by the name of Pittston at that period of time. And Pittston was headed by the son of a really liberal senator, Paul Douglas.
It's ironic. He was a great New Dealer.
Yeah, he was. And now his son's running his company, and he's trying to do the exact opposite. He has a guy in charge of the company that's a former submarine captain, Joe Farrell. And Farrell wants to do us in. And we were the second in line. Because Pittston owned the armored car business, the Brinks armored car business,
right?
And the Teamsters represented the guards. Well, they filed a legal suit saying that they're not eligible to be represented because they're security guards, therefore they get rid of them. And the NLRB at that time, the Reagan NLRB, says you're right. So they get rid of them. They bust the union. Teamsters are gone out of Brinks.
Wow.
that whetted their appetite. And he said, let's try these mine worker guys next and see if we can't get rid of them. So after we signed the national contract, they said, we're not going to adhere to the national standards. We're not going to pay health care for your pensioners. Mm-hmm. We're going to get rid of that.
They're not going to pay into a plan that went way back to 1950, right? John L. Lewis
Took care of the older pensioners, yeah.
Right.
And so they said, we're going to take you on. And I said, well, you may, but we're gonna fight you. Prior to that time, we had a special convention in 1985, and I did two things at that convention. Mm-hmm. One, I created a strike fund. The mine workers never had a strike fund.
Mm-hmm.
And it gave me the ability to take 3% of gross wages, including overtime, came into the strike fund. And in a matter of a little over a year, we created a $100 million strike fund, which was formidable.
Yeah.
So we created a strike fund, and we did away with the provision in the contract. We used to have a provision in the contract, the mine workers' contract, that says no contract, no work.
Mm.
So they could predict a second that you were going to go on strike.
Right.
And I said, I'm not willing to give them that kind of predictability.
Yeah.
So I did away with that. I got the miners to do away with that provision, changed our constitution that gave me the ability to call a strike or not to call a strike.
Right.
And so with Pittston, we didn't call a strike. When a contract expired.
One of the really interesting things about what you're saying here is that I would imagine that Pittston probably wanted a strike in some ways, because you think about how employers were breaking unions in the 80s, like at Hormel, Greyhound, Phelps Dodge and others. So
the union movement desperately needed a win to break that cycle.
Right.
Because after Reagan broke the PATCO, he said to every employer out there, it's okay to break unions, go have it.
Right.
And a lot of them did. You just named the list a partial list of things that happened. Yeah. There were a lot more. And so Pittston was looking forward to that.
Right.
They had hired a biker gang to be their scabs.
Wow.
They wanted us to go on strike, and we didn't go on strike at first.
Mm.
We stayed and we worked to the contract, and we didn't for two reasons go on strike. One, I didn't want to give them the predictability, and two, we really weren't prepared. Our guys weren't prepared to go on strike yet. So we had to train them, and we trained them in peaceful civil disobedience, which was probably a break from a lot of the past, particularly in parts of Appalachia where this was happening.
Sure.
And so we trained them in peaceful civil disobedience, and we worked to the rule for a while.
Mm-hmm.
It's tough for my guys to work to the rule.
Yeah.
Because when they get in the mine, all they want to do is load coal.
Right.
They're just hard workers, and they don't know anything else. They just go do it. It gave us the time we needed to train everybody, to get the word out, to prepare, to ask for help from the AFL-CIO and the labor movement. You remember, we weren't affiliated with the AFL-CIO back at that period of time.
Right.
The affiliation came right afterward.
Mm-hmm.
The other unions were incredible in their support and solidarity.
Mm.
And then we, after we worked through that, we decided there was an opportune time for us to go on strike because they had orders coming up, and we were able to do it.
Mm. And you did use those nonviolent tactics.
We did.
How did that come about, and how successful was that? How did your guys respond to that? As you say, this is not in the culture necessarily.
At first, they kept looking sort of with the jaundiced eye.
And they were wearing camouflage and stuff.
We did that for two reasons.
Okay.
We wore camouflage. One, frequently in the past when something would happen, they would say to a scab or a management guy, okay, who did that?
Right.
Who threw a rock? Who did this? And then the guy in the red hat.
Yeah, right.
Lying.
Yeah.
But he had somebody to pick out. Yeah. That's how I knew, because he had a red hat.
Right.
So we had everybody wear camouflage. And what did he say? It was the guy in the camouflage?
Yeah.
We were all an army. No more individuals. Mm-hmm. We were one homogeneous, solidary army in solidarity. Mm-hmm. So that was one reason we did that. The second reason we did it was cheap. Well, most of our guys already had camo, so it was
they wore it hunting and stuff.
Yeah, everything. You know? So it was a natural color for us to have,
right.
And it did. It signified the army that we were, and we were all no more individuals. We were all one, and it worked out real well.
Seemed like probably the most successful deployment of nonviolence, massive civil disobedience since the civil rights movement, maybe.
Indeed, we had probably I think the records show almost 5,000, but in reality there were probably almost double that, because they didn't keep records at the first until they started bringing the buses in, and we asked people
who got arrested. You mean is that what you're talking?
Yeah. So we probably had about 8,000 people. That got arrested in peaceful civil disobedience there, including Lane Kirkland, myself, and a number of others. But when people would say, "What can we do to help you?"
Right.
We would say, "Come to Camp Sol." Camp Solidarity, every Wednesday we had a giant rally. People would come for the rally, they would send money, they'd bring stuff, and it was like an infectious thing. When you left Camp Solidarity, you were full of solidarity for sure, because you saw it there. That strike lasted almost a year, and not a single mine worker crossed the picket line.
Wow.
Not one.
Wow.
Not one crossed the picket line. We were proud
remarkable.
Of that. And so miners came from all around to help us. And the AFL-CIO was a tremendous help. And the unions were a tremendous help. That solidarity allowed our people to give them the courage to continue on every day.
Well, as you say, this was something the labor movement desperately needed after, 8 years of Reagan and that disaster.
Yeah. Yeah, because everybody until that time, no one had conducted a successful strike until Pittston, and that really was the turning point.
Right.
After Pittston, more people started doing successful strikes, and so it was our contribution back to the mine, to the labor movement, saying, "Here's one more place where the mine workers can make a contribution and help with the solidarity." I mean, you know our history.
Right.
We organized all the major industrial unions with our money and our organizers and gave them their union. And so this was yet another way that we were able to pitch in and be helpful.
Part one of our interview with Richard Trumka back in 2019 on the 30th anniversary of the historic Pittston strike and the 10th anniversary of his election as president of the AFL-CIO. We've got a link to part two in the show notes. Here is Rick Smith with part two of our remembrance of the Upper Big Branch mine disaster.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 2010. That was the day an explosion in the Upper Big Branch mine killed 29 miners. This is the second of two parts commemorating that disastrous moment in labor history. The accumulation of explosive methane gas was so pronounced that the mine had to be evacuated several times leading up to the disaster. A 126-page Governor's Independent Investigation Panel report detailed the systemic failures of safety systems and at governmental agencies charged with enforcing regulation. Lack of proper ventilation, adherence to rock dusting standards, and proper maintenance of machinery were main factors. The panel also held the Mine Safety and Health Administration responsible for disregarding the documented risk of methane outbursts at the mine, overlooking the deadly potential of a precarious ventilation system, neglecting to use its regulatory authority to force technological improvements, and allowing the U.S. mine safety system to atrophy. They determined that MSHA could have issued flagrant violation citations and had the authority to shut the mines down, but didn't. The report noted the cozy relations between mine owners, politicians, judges, and regulators. Specifically, the ease with which state mine officials move from employment with industry to government and back. Despised union-busting CEO Don Blankenship, who was tried and convicted to 1 year in jail, insisted his mines were safe. He cited three Sentinels of Safety awards received from MSHA in 2009. These awards went to surface mining and coal processing plant operations. Blankenship even blamed MSHA for the explosion because the agency demanded changes in UBB's ventilation system. A union safety committee could have shut the mine down before methane gas and coal dust combined to cause the explosion. If only there had been a union.
Every baby is what he had to say. Look out the window, I'm in the driveway. Come and meet me at the door. You and Mama don't have to worry anymore. 'Cause I'm home, and Daddy's home. We don't have to cry.
Hey, that's it for this week's special edition of Labor History Today. You can subscribe to LHT on your favorite podcast app. Even better, if you like what you hear, sure hope you do. Like it in your podcast app, pass it along, and leave a review. That really helps folks to find the show. Labor History in 2 is a partnership between the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show. That's a labor-themed radio show out of Pennsylvania. Special thanks this week to the AFL-CIO's Daily Brief newsletter, whose Flashback Friday item about the Pittston strike anniversary reminded me to dig the Trumka interview out of our archives. Our music today was Ballad of the Pittston Coal Strike by Brian Reliva, and Josh Adair's tribute to the victims of the Big Branch mine disaster, Daddy's Home.
That same mama standing with tears in her eyes when the mine foreman tells her she said her last goodbyes to a man who gave his life trying to provide for his family. But their son will never see him say, Daddy's home.
Labor History Today is produced by the Labor Heritage Foundation and the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown University. You can keep up with all the latest labor arts news. Subscribe to the Labor Heritage Foundation's free weekly newsletter at laborheritage.org. The Labor History Today team includes Ben Blake, Patrick Dixon, Leon Fink, Sherry Lincoln, Joe McCartan, Evan Papp, Jessica Pozak, and Alan Weirdeck. For Labor History Today, this has been Chris Garlock. Thanks so much for listening. Keep making history, and see you next time.
Daddy's home, so dry your eyes. He's a little tired from that mind. But he can rest easy now, 'cause Daddy's home. We don't have to cry. Daddy's home. So dry your eyes. 29 died in that Big Branch mine. But he can rest easy now, 'cause they're all home. Oh.